Welcome, welcome to those who are just dialing in for Coffee with Decoder, episode 83. Paula, I'm sorry I cut that off for you.
No, that's okay.
That information in the private page for the insiders, and I'm sure Christine will post it on the LinkedIn insider part, so that way they can get the information. So, yay!
Yeah, let me finish. Just say this last little. Let me just say this last little thing I wanted to say, just because it cut me off in the middle of it. So, if you are on a financial institution's website, the web address, I want to make sure you heard that, starts with HTTPS, and there should be a closed lock icon near the address bar. You should also check the site security certificate. You know, make sure you're updating your virus software routinely. Experts recommend even that we perform our own cyber attacks in our organization, and of course, using those strong passwords and two-factor authentication is heavily preferred. So I just wanted to say that we were talking about HIPAA today, guys, for anybody who didn't dial into the pre-show. But Pam, go ahead now. I just wanted to finish up saying that because that's an important thing.
That was a little teaser for those of you who haven't learned to dial in early yet. Okay, so but if you are in the private Facebook group or the LinkedIn group, you'll be able to rehear that portion of it later today. So welcome, welcome to episode 83, everyone. We've got some questions lined up. Can't wait to tell you about them. There's also a webinar coming up tomorrow on reporting ambulance services. Paula will be delving into that for us. It'll be about an hour, starting at noon Eastern. And if you haven't already signed up, please do so. Just go to aq-iq.com. It's the very first post right underneath the picture. So looking forward to that. We've got some more stuff to talk about, and we'll probably get to that in just a little bit. Can I go ahead and start giving you questions?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, sweet. Okay, so the very first one is anonymous. And I don't know. I think that this must be confusing because I've seen lots of people that got denied because of it. So it says, what are the required components of an acute hospital inpatient order?
Yeah, we see a lot of issues with this, too, as we're auditing in hospitals. It's a common, I guess, trend. So we wanted to give you, you know, chapter and verse, if you will. So the Medicare Benefit Policy Manual 10.2 says the physician order that the patient should be formally admitted for the hospital inpatient care. So when the physician is writing the order, it says the order must specify that the admitting physician's recommendation is to admit to inpatient status or as an inpatient or for inpatient services or similar language, specifying that his or her recommendation is for inpatient care, not admit to Dr. So-and-so or admit to fourth floor, admit to, you know, whatever. But it needs to be very clear the status, I would say, of the fact that the physician is wanting the patient to be in an inpatient status. Now, the order must also be authenticated by an appropriate party who is licensed by the state to do so. Of course, that would be a physician, has privileges at the hospital or entity, and knowledge of the patient's hospital course, medical plan of care, and current condition at the time of admission. So that's the physician needs to have that information in order to and authenticate that order. In addition, it goes on in 10.2 to say regarding timing, it says the order must be furnished at or before the time of the inpatient admission. The order can be written in advance of the formal admission, so for a pre-scheduled surgery, for example, but the inpatient admission does not occur until the hospital care services are provided to the beneficiary. Authentication by the ordering practitioner is required prior to discharge for all inpatient cases. And that's one of those things that's misunderstood often. The order needs to be written before the patient goes into that inpatient status, but it can be authenticated needs to be authenticated as far as timing before the patient leaves the hospital, before they're discharged in all inpatient cases. And I couldn't find it written, but I know when we're talking about certification as well, the expected length of stay needs to be there in order to meet that 2-midnight requirement. So at some place, the physician needs to identify that he expects the patient, the expected length of stay, actually.
Thank you.
Pam?
Thank you. Yes, it can get pretty complicated, right?
Oh, yeah.
but,
Complicated. It's easy but complicated.
yes, easy but not simple. anyway, so
Yeah,
my
that's
next
it.
question is, it's also anonymous. Oh boy, I'm copying down phone numbers now. This is regarding CBT in outpatient. How do you code a colonoscopy with cold snare versus cold biopsy forceps?
Yeah, that's a good one. I used to work for a GI doc 100 years ago. And anyway, that we didn't have all the codes we have now, but as auditing them, that's one of those questions you go, okay, if you hadn't coded in a while, you go, what? The easiest way to remember the answer here, really, and this is not a technical answer, this first thing I'm going to say is just drop the word cold. A snare removal is reported with 45385. And that code is colonoscopy with removal of tumors, polyps, and other lesions by snare technique. And cold biopsy forceps, or biopsy forceps, it really is a biopsy. So 45380, colonoscopy with biopsy, single or multiple. Cold forceps are often referred to as cold biopsy forceps, which, and they are typically used, the intent of using them is to do a biopsy. So, and this code's not going to be used. You're not going to use 45380 if a snare is used. I think they're using cold snare a lot more, at least with what I've seen. And removing by snare is a different procedure than those cold biopsy forceps, which is it's usually a smaller piece that's taken. Also, with a snare, typically the whole lesion is removed, and that is the intent. And it can be with cold biopsy forceps, but just for remembering which code to use, if it says snare, cold snare, then you're going to report 45385 for cold snare.
Thank
Pam?
you. Thank you. Yes, and I have another anonymous question. Like I said, I'm sitting over here copying phone numbers as quickly as I can. That means someone who just dialed in today and didn't even, whether they ask a question or not, they're still in the running for the mugging today. This one is from an inpatient rehab. They say a patient was admitted for debility due to metabolic encephalopathy. What would be the principal diagnosis for the UBO4?
Yeah, that's a good one too. The principal diagnosis is determined, of course, differently than the etiologic. So sometimes you have folks who are coding for both the IRF-PI and the UBO4, and sometimes the coders don't know they're coding for the IRF-PI. So there's a disconnect there, and the PPS coordinator or CMG coordinator has to figure out what goes where. Except the coder is always coding for the UBO4. So when they're asking, when she's this coder, I said she, but I don't know if it's a she or a he, but when this coder was asking about the principal diagnosis, they're referring to the UBO4 because if they use the term etiologic, they're referring to the IRF-PI. Now, let's talk about some rules for coding the principal versus the etiologic. The etiologic can be resolved. So in this case, for example, the patient was maybe admitted for due to metabolic encephalopathy, they had this debility. But say, let's just say, in our example, I'm making this up, that's not the way the question was worded, but the metabolic encephalopathy was resolved, but the patient still had some debility associated with that. In that case, the metabolic encephalopathy would still be the underlying reason that caused the need for rehab, and it would be listed as the etiologic. However, on the UBO4, because it no longer existed, the symptom of the debility would be reported as the principal diagnosis. But on the UBO4, if it still existed, because anything we put on the UBO4, including the principal diagnosis, it has to still exist. So if the condition still exists, and was, causing the admission. So it is the chief reason for occasioning the admission that is determined after careful study. That is the definition of a principal diagnosis. Then that metabolic encephalopathy, if it still existed, would be the principal diagnosis. So I know it sounded like it might be a short answer, but it was a little bit longer. So guys, hey, let me say this before I turn it back over to Pam. please, please, please tell your friends. Please, please, please send in your questions. You know, as you're working in the workday and a question pops in your brain, you know, maybe even if you find the answer, send it to us, because we need to increase this bank of questions and share with all your fellow coders that are and other, you know, PPS coordinators and, you know, CDI folks and others, billers that are calling in. So we just need some questions, and we need to get your names on here too, so we can mug you sometime. So Pam, I'm going to turn it back over to you.
Thank you, thank you. Okay, so I am going to mug someone who dialed in today, and just checking to make sure. Okay, I had them under the table. That way I'm not just choosing a name. And I pulled one out, and the one on top is the phone number ends in 2598. So I think I know your name, but that may not be the case. I will try calling you if your number ends in that. You'll look forward to a question, to a phone call from me. Thanks for joining us here today. In 2 weeks, it will be February the 24th, and we will have episode 84. We'd love to have your question. Also, we're going to have a webinar tomorrow about ambulance coding, ambulance service reporting, ambulance services. So if that's something that you deal with in your day-to-day, then reach out to us and join the webinar. Looking forward to seeing you in something that we're doing. There's also an IRF Pro Labs and Revenue Worries, lots of stuff coming up. So check aq-iq.com and our social media.